1, extension 2547.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades of Amandla Radio, welcome back to this edition of our show for 1st of September 2021 here at CQUT 90.3. We're a bilingual news and analysis of the continent of Africa. I'm Doug Miller, and tonight I have two things to share with you. It's been a long time since we've dealt with the question of Canadian aid and where does Canada stand on it. I have an interview with Owen Schalk, a writer and activist from Winnipeg, who wrote an excellent article in the most recent edition, August, of Canadian Dimension. Highly recommended to you. Stay tuned and listen to that. And then out of The Guardian was a story very close to my heart of Lake Chilwa in Malawi drying up. And after I had read the article, I realized that the chief investigator who led the research and the action on rehabilitating the lake and the people who depended on it for a livelihood, he was a student of mine in Malawi when I was there in the 60s. And that led me to think about Lake Chad. So I have a follow-up story on Lake Chad. So stay tuned for Amandla. At Amandla have long criticized Canadian programs purporting to aid countries develop, and were not particularly surprised or disappointed when the Conservative government of the unlamented Stephen Harper amalgamated the old Canadian International Development Agency along with Foreign Affairs and International Trade, since that was clearly how the governments over the many, many decades regarded the fact that they wanted aid money to benefit Canadian business. Self-disclosure notice before I continue with this introduction of the rest of this piece. I wrote my master's thesis in sociology in 1998, and the title was Women, Development, and Social Change, The Women of Rural Malawi, a Case Study, in which I examined how the dominant development paradigm espoused by the World Bank, the IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, led to the impoverishment and social political disadvantage of Malawi's rural women. To my great pleasure, the recent edition of Canadian Dimension came into my email inbox, and there was an article from by Owen Schalk,
entitled How Canadian Aid is Stifling Development and Prosperity in West Africa. Here's that. He immediately asked him to join us on Amanda to present his ideas, and he immediately responded yes. So here's that interview.
I'm here tonight with Owen Schock. He's a writer from Winnipeg. His areas of interest include post-colonialism and the human impact of the global neoliberal economy. He's written fiction for Fairlight Books, the Anti-Langouris Project, and Sobotka Library Magazine, and nonfiction for Alborada, the Canadian Files, or Connect, the Canada Files, and People's Voice. He's also a regular contributor to Canadian Dimension, and to my great pleasure, a recent edition of the Canadian Dimension came into my email inbox. And I still miss those good old days of the paper edition. The Canadian Dimension has always been a go-to read for me, as coming as it does from Canada's hotbed of socialist thinking and activists, Winnipeg. I was even more delighted to see an article entitled How Canadian Aid is Stifling Development and Prosperity in West Africa, written by Owen. And I immediately asked him to join us on Amanda to present his ideas. So good evening, Owen.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm just so pleased to read an article about this subject. It's a very subject very close to us here at Amandla. What led to your interest in the issue of Canadian aid in the first place?
Well, so like any socialist or left-wing person in Canada, someone who's interested in the reasons for inequality and how inequality perpetuates itself, my research eventually led me to investigate my own country's role and the contradiction inherent in Canada's brand as a global peacekeeper and as a champion of human rights around the world. And that didn't really fit with the history you read of Canada being a state which maintains cordial relations with a lot of the most draconian governments in the world. And so the question emerges from that, what is the reality of Canada's global role? And there was no particular event that led me to investigate the issue of aid specifically, but it just seemed like a logical next step. Because when you're investigating these national myths and you're trying to get through them and see what's beyond, you have to go after the most prominent ones. And one of the most enduring myths in Canada is that it is this state which is defined by generosity and this idea of liberal internationalism. It's still central to our culture today. And I remember reading Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And what he put forward there is that you have to understand the dialectic between the global north and the south, or the metropole and the colony or the neo-colony, and how that relates to foreign aid. And Canada's foreign aid in particular really ties into this underdevelopment, the promotion of business, the mining industry, and all of that. And I just found out quite soon that aid in a lot of ways actually maintains structures of inequality rather than alleviating them.
Oh boy, that's a good start, boy. Oh boy, Walter Rodney, of course, is a foundational thinker for this kind of thing about Africa. Given that the time when he was writing was so key to African countries just becoming independent and trying to think their way out of the colonial box, and he sure did it. Can you sort of describe from there? From that intro, how you then moved into this, you write about the poverty reduction strategy papers of the IMF. Boy, oh boy, you sure know how to find dry subjects.
Well, you know, yeah, I was a slow evening and I found myself on the IMF website, just clicking around. And yeah, I came upon this page of the poverty reduction strategy papers and I just started browsing it. And what I found that was it was almost darkly funny, is that all of the countries that have the most poverty reduction papers are the most impoverished countries in the world. So from there, you have to realize that either the IMF is bad at its job or poverty reduction is not the actual goal. And if you look at how the IMF has functioned in the world after the Cold War, what they really promote around the world is structural adjustment and the privatization of these countries' resources. And when you privatize these countries' resources and foreign companies come in and buy them up, they're not concerned with the well-being of the people in those countries. They just want to extract profit. And so you have this situation where the IMF is both promoting the extraction of profit in these countries while claiming that it wants to reduce poverty. And it puts out these strategy papers one every few years, usually for countries in Africa since around 2000. And things just continue to get worse. In Burkina Faso, for instance, even the Government of Canada website admits that the main problem facing Burkina Faso is that the poverty is increasing for the majority of the population. And yet there are like 12 or 13 strategy papers on the IMF website. It's one of the countries that has the most. And so from there, I just thought, okay, how does this connect to Canadian aid? Because clearly, like with Canadian aid, the IMF, there's something more going on here. It's not, you can't just take it at its word that it wants to alleviate poverty and that it's a benign force in the world. Clearly, there's something more going on. And what is going on is privatization and global capitalist expansion.
Now, can you just elaborate a little more on these inconsistencies? How impoverishment and poverty come out of those strategies, even though the facade they put forward is one of beneficence and generosity?
Mm-hmm. So the Indian economist Prabhat Patnaik, he wrote an essay called A Left Approach to Development. And in that essay, he talks about two different approaches to development, a means-based approach and a rights-based approach. And what he says about the means-based approach is that this is what predominates in the world today. It's what you see with the IMF or with Canadian aid, for that matter. And what a means-based approach entails is basically it joins development aid to profit and to capitalist expansion. It basically posits that the way to alleviate poverty is to spread the means of production and consumption of the global north into the global south throughout Africa, and that when these productive modes reach there, it will inevitably alleviate poverty because the market is God, basically. Everything comes back to the market. And so if you want to alleviate poverty, you have to do it through the global capitalist market. And that's what the means-based approach that Patnaik talks about is. And that's what the IMF puts forward in its structural adjustment policies.
And Canada, as you say, is very much wed to that that philosophy, and for that matter, as one of the G7 countries, sits on the board of the IMF and develops those neoliberal. Well, that's the other thing. This is neoliberalism, just written with another name, right?
Oh, absolutely. And if you're talking about the G7 and the G8, in 2003, Canada was on the G8 Action Plan for Africa was the name of it. And they put forward a program called the Canadian Investment Fund for Africa, where they put $100 million into it. And they partnered with the Colonial Development Corporation of Britain, which put forward $60 million.
I think it's now Commonwealth Development.
They changed it, but it's the same acronym.
And it basically says the same function, right. I think. Oh, you're absolutely right. It was Colonial Development, though.
And they formed into this essentially a private equity firm to invest in Africa and extract profit under the guise of alleviating poverty. And the Government of Canada website, the page for the CIFA, the Canadian Investment Fund for Africa, they say that it has brought $30 million of profit into Canada. So clearly, if you're talking about neoliberal development policies, it seems to me that oftentimes behind closed doors, they probably talk about the profit that they're extracting and how that's the overall goal, but they have to put forward this veneer of poverty alleviation, because otherwise, I mean, it's just naked robbery.
And it's totally inconsistent to believe that you are alleviating poverty when you're draining so much wealth out of a country.
Oh, absolutely. And I always go back to Rodney, you know, talking about underdevelopment, and you have to understand that the industrialization of these Western countries is dependent upon that extraction of the wealth. And that back in the days of formal colonialism, they had their justifications too. They said that it was a civilizing mission. They were going to spread the light of Christianity and all of that. And in a way, now what we say is that we're spreading, you know, the means as Pat and I talked about, the means to bring about poverty alleviation. But at base, it's the same thing. It's just a change from colonialism to neo-colonialism.
Wow. You talked about a former World Bank chief economist and how he exemplifies the true crassness of this capitalist model of development.
Oh, yes. Larry Summers, also former president of Harvard. He said that, what did he say? He basically had a memo in 1991 that was leaked. And in this memo, he says that the economic logic for dumping toxic waste in what he calls the least productive countries, I believe, is impeccable because these countries do not produce as much as the global north or the industrialized west for the global economy. And it's such a revealing quote because although it is so crass, as you say, it encapsulates the logic by which the means-based approach operates, because it says that these people who are receiving aid and the people in what Summers calls the least productive countries or the least developed countries, in order to be deserving of the beneficence of the World Bank or the IMF or Canada, they have to produce some return on investment. And although what Larry Summers says in that memo about dumping toxic waste is it's so crass and so just unbelievably stomach churning and revolting, that's basically the same logic that our current aid initiatives operate on.
Absolutely. It takes me back. I did once study literature a bit, and Jonathan Swift wrote a book, wrote a treatise called A Modest Proposal, in which the British economist, operating very much like this chief economist from the World Bank, proposed that the Irish could overcome their poverty by selling their surplus children for food, as food for the British to eat. And it just parodied the dogmatism of these kinds of top-down elitist development economists. Anyway, it's just flabbergasting.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're talking about parody, that Summers memo, it's almost self-parody. Like, it's hard to imagine somebody who actually believes that, but this is how people at his level talk.
And believe it. They actually believe it. Mm-hmm. Of course, we only need to refer to about 2 years back when Donald Trump, the president of the United States, said, "Why can't we get people from? Why do we always have these people from the shithole countries coming here to
exactly.
the United States?" I mean, jeepers, mm-hmm. creepers, guys, get over it. So it's doomed to fail as a development policy. First, the Canadian government, can you give us a little more background on their mix with West Africa? Because that article was about West Africa. What are we doing as Canadian government, we supposed to be represented by them. What are we doing in Burkina Faso and Mali? I think those were your true chief focus, right?
Yeah. And just to give some background here, I have an excerpt from a 2003 policy document released by the Harper government called the Global Market Action Plan. And in this, they're basically laying out how Canada can increase its influence in the world. And what it says is, under the Global Markets Action Plan, Canada's interests will be advanced by leveraging development programming to advance Canada's trade interests. And that lays it out pretty blatantly. And I think that's how Canadian aid functions under a Liberal government, for sure, and especially since the end of the Cold War. But there's something about the way that the Conservatives put it there that is just really blatant. And if we're talking about West Africa, one of the programs that I talk about in the article is called the West Africa Governance and Economic Sustainability in Extractive Areas Program, or WAGES. And it was launched in 2016. It focuses on the mining regions in Burkina Faso, Ghana, and Guinea. And the ways that it seeks to reduce poverty in these regions, the ways that it puts forward, include strengthening local extractive businesses and providing training to Africans in these countries to work in this industry, an industry which is dominated by Canadian capital. Because in 2009, in Burkina Faso, gold surpassed cotton as the main export. And currently, Canadian mining companies own over half of Burkina Faso's gold mines. And so if you look at these these programs in West Africa, these aid programs for jobs, training, and extractive industries. In Burkina Faso, in Mali too, where Canadian mining is also a powerhouse, they own the two largest mining companies in mines in Mali. What a lot of these aid programs end up doing is coming back and benefiting Canadian capital and profiting Canadian mining companies by basically subsidizing their job training.
Wow. Now, did you find out anything about how the NGOs were being used to palliate a bit the abuses and exploitation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I can't remember the name of the NGOs that implemented wages, but there were two of them. And yeah, they basically, the jobs training programs were, it was given, the duties were given to these NGOs to operate in Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Ghana. And actually, I actually don't know. That's one area where my knowledge is sort of limited, is how these NGOs are used to diffuse responsibility for this. Maybe perhaps you could talk about how the NGOs, the NGOification of Canadian aid came about and how that exists today in Africa.
Well, to some extent, and I'm not an expert and I haven't researched it for this show very well, but to some extent, the NGOs become subcontractors to what was the old CEDA and now what Global Affairs Canada, and it's cheap aid rather than paying high paid professionals to go out and do things that they don't value that much, like education and health, because it doesn't profit. They download it to the NGO sector to take on in their many different phases or facades. The NGO world has become its own industry now. It's no longer a stopgap measures to what we used to say in CUSA, we're only there long enough till we're out of a job. Well, that never happened. These agencies now thrive off of these government contracts. So non-government, yes, but governmental contracts and so on. I can't give you a chapter and verse from the Bible at this moment, but now that you've brought it up, I certainly will do that research again. We've been collecting that for many, many years and planning to even write about it. But I was really focused on your article today, so you caught me off guard a bit there.
Well, what's interesting too, just to say, is how the sort of the interventionist model of foreign aid that has really been growing since the end of the Cold War sort of grew in tandem with, you know, subcontracting to these NGOs, because, you know, in the 50s, 60s, whatever, Canadian aid, or rather the Canadian state, it would just sort of promote Canadian business in the countries where it was investing. So for instance, India and Pakistan, under the Colombo Plan, what the Canadian government did is basically help to get contracts to build hydroelectric dams, nuclear power plants, things like that. But now you have a situation in Colombia, for example, where CETA actually intervened in Colombian affairs and rewrote their mining code to benefit Canadian companies. I mean, that's on another level.
That's a whole other level. And in fact, we met in Malawi, getting on the plane one day, leaving the country, two gentlemen from the Canadian Mining Association, one of them a functionary of the association and the other a high-level mining exec. And they had just been in Malawi to help them rewrite their mining code. Well, why don't we hire the foxes to protect the chicken coop, huh?
That's so interesting. And from reading Eve Engler, he wrote a book about Canada in Africa, and he mentions that they did similar things in Ghana, I believe, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and all over. But so many of these just don't get documented.
Well, no, and that's where the extractive industry is, and amalgamating Canadian aid into the foreign affairs and trade and industry blurs the lines very, very substantially. It's a mix that is doomed to fail for the people that it's supposed to be helping. Now, interesting, those mining companies are making huge profits over there because of the lack of local regulations, labor codes, environmental codes, et cetera. And yet they couldn't do that here with the same profitability. We saw that particularly with uranium, but it's also true of those other mines as well. My goodness gracious, where are we going? This is so discouraging, Owen. What? Look, the late unlamented Margaret Thatcher said of capitalism after the fall of the Soviet Union, Tina, she said, T-I-N-A, there is no alternative to the capitalist way. Gosh, Owen, is there another way out of this for the countries of Africa? Do they have to put up with this for another century of colonialism?
Well, there are certainly models that we can look back to of people who tried to change this. The first one that comes to mind is Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso, who he took power
our
in 1983.
Real hero. He's our hero.
A great, great man. And he wanted to completely change West Africa's relationship to the former colonial power, France. And he sought to bring total food self-sufficiency to Burkina Faso to basically de-link from the logic of the global capitalist economy. And this is what the Egyptian economist Samir Amin writes about, the need to de-connect and to create your own, what he calls auto-centric economy that survives and thrives outside the logic of global capitalism. And this is what Sankara tried, and it was working. He was doing it until Blaise Compaoré, his former advisor, in collaboration with French regional actors like Félix Houphouët-Boigny in the Ivory Coast, they did a coup and they killed him. But if you want something encouraging, you could say that it was working, and it was, and you should say it. And even though he came up against all of this opposition, and even though in the end, in that instance, it didn't work out, we can always be encouraged by the fact that he started doing it, and he was doing it, and it was working. And we should always look back on that.
And of course, you and I are sitting here commenting on it. And the fact is, it's our government that is providing this model to the IMF and the World Bank by sitting on the board, by contributing their funds, and by controlling the agenda. And of course, reducing the voice of the poorest countries on those very institutions who should be better represented to ensure their needs are met. What can we do here?
Well, I mean, the problem here is that it's hard to think of a person in government at this point at the level of decision making who is amenable to these demands. If you could organize, if you want, you could locate in a pressure point, if you will, and apply pressure there. But I think that has to only be one aspect of it. There has to as well be a movement like Sankara or a figure like that in the countries that we are talking about, who is working to totally reorganize the way that global capitalism works. And we can do that here through, I don't know, through organizing, through stuff like that. But it is a really difficult question. And where it does get discouraging is trying to figure out what we in these, traditionally globally dominant imperialist countries can actually do. And in terms of that approach, options are limited, but they exist. And if you want something encouraging, it could be that these options do actually exist and that they are available to us.
I mean, we can only look at our own national problem with the extractive industries, and particularly the so-called energy industry, the fossil fuel industry, and how they seem to have a stranglehold over the government. They will not give up. They will not let go. And the government is funneling money into them hand over fist and not into alternative energies or anything. It's just so frustrating.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, Owen, any last thoughts about all this and where it's going and more articles coming?
Yeah, I'm always working. I started a Substack recently where I was writing. I started a series called Victims of Canadian Aid. And for the first one, I did Guatemala, and I went back to the Arbenz coup and Canada's complicity in that. I will be doing more pieces there on Colombia, Mali, whatever I can find. And I just had a piece out in the Canada Files about Western aid in Haiti. And so you can check that out on their website.
Well, thanks a lot. And please keep thinking of Amanda. If anything comes up, send it our way.
Absolutely. This was great.
And if you would give us the details of your, you call it a stack. I'm not quite sure. I'm so old.
It's called substack.com. And you would just search owenshock.substack.com. And you'll see a bunch of articles I wrote. I'm writing about a lot of different things like history, film, literature, politics, stuff like that. And you can just go and subscribe. And so you'll get an email every time I post something there. And then also keep an eye out for my stuff at Canadian Dimension, The Canada Files, People's Voice, all these different lefty Canadian outlets.
Well, thanks a lot for doing this. It's a long overdue and can never be repeated enough that we have to change this exploitative relationship with the poor. Well, they are poor countries because we've kept them poor. And yes. And so we have to change it. And thanks again for writing on Haiti as well, because that's outrageous Canadian behavior down there.
It's unbelievable.
Well, and good luck. Best wishes in everything you do. Thanks again for contributing this article to Canadian Dimension and explaining it to our listeners here at Amandla.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Kajama mawa amatenga taje kusesa bakomo bakomo pama iwaje
kajama mawa
early morning
amatenga taje
kusesa bakomo bakomo lama iwaje
magolo ali
magolo ali na
muya mikila
akudini nerero mwana mene mwana wanzero
Magolo aline,
magolo aline,
amu ya mikila.
Akutiri nderero mwana mene, mwana wanzeru.
Line,
line, oh,
line, oh,
line, oh. Uyu linderero mwana mene, mwana wanzeru.
Boats are stranded and the fish and ducks are gone. Fishermen and farmers who depended on Lake Chilwa are desperately looking for alternative income. That's after low rainfall and rising temperatures have caused Malawi's second largest lake to dry up.
The drying of the lake has put us in an awkward situation. We had good fish markets. Now we don't have work because there's no fish.
1.5 million people live around Lake Chilwa. It once provided about 30% of the fish Malawians ate, and it was home to nearly 200 species of birds.
So you can actually see that the drying of the lake and the seizing of the fishing has affected the whole value chain of the fishermen that bring the fish, the buyers, as well as the processors and the transporters.
The lake has dried up completely several times in the past 100 years, but extreme weather is causing it to evaporate more frequently.
And so climate change contributes to the current recessions that we are experiencing. Because you can see that in 2012, there was a recession where the lake lost about 80% of its water. Then it recovered in 2013, but not fully.
Unless the water rises again, residents may be forced to rebuild their lives elsewhere or die like the lake. Christine Pirovolakis, TRT World.
The clip you've just heard was from Turkish television. I found it on YouTube. It's a short 2-minute piece about how Lake Chilwa, Malawi's second largest lake, has been drying up. Now, it has a history of drying on a cyclical period, but cyclical being once every 35 or 50 years, it's now every second year. The lake dries up because, unlike Lake Malawi, which is fed by mountain streams and rivers and from the north in Tanzania right through to Mozambique and Malawi, and then drains off into the Zambezi through the Shiri River, Lake Chirwa is one of those rare inland lakes which hasn't got an outlet. It is fed by streams that are rain-fed, and when the rains are bad, it will get small. And so what they were explaining to us that in 2012, it almost disappeared. Now, what I found then was an article in the August 30th Guardian, where it explains that the struggle for food as Malawi's Lake Chilwa shrinks. Chilwa, C-H-I-L-W-A. The article and photographs are the articles by Madalitso Wills Katete in Zomba, and it has a number of very excellent photographs to display what actually is happening there. I was both excited and proud as I read the article, because the chief biologist in charge of the project is Sostin Chota, and he was a student of mine when I taught at Mitundu Secondary School in 1969, and he became a PhD biologist and is head of the Leadership for Environment and Development Southern and Eastern Africa. He's the regional director, Sostin Chota. So that's the guy you heard speaking at the end of that piece. Now, the interesting thing about the lake, as I said, is that it's inland drainage. It doesn't have it doesn't drain out. It just, there's only lakes coming in, or water coming in. And when he reached the explorer David Livingston reached the lake in 1859, he reported it being 60 to 80 miles long, or roughly twice the size it is today. Now, the water levels do vary by season, and the lake can cover as much as 2,000 square kilometers. But in recent years, we've seen it contract to less than 1,200 square kilometers. In 2018, the lake shrank about 60%, forcing most of the people fishing on it to relocate to Lake Malawi to sustain themselves. There just wasn't the capacity for the fish to reproduce and feed the population that was living off of it. And the fears are that the trend could be repeated this year, as Lake Chilwa Basin received less than 1,000 millimeters of rain this year. It actually requires a meter of rain across the basin every year to sustain water levels. The unreliable rainfall patterns are, according to experts, the result of human activity, especially deforestation, which plays a critical role in environmental degradation and climate crisis. But added to that is the larger climate issue of irregular rains, erratic droughts, periodic droughts, and more frequent heavy rains and longer stretches of drought than one would have expected in the past. The story goes on and talks to different fishermen and people who explain their problems living with the issues that of poverty and the drying up of the lake. But my student Sostin Chota says the lake is drying out more frequently as the climate crisis causes more extreme weather. Climate change has introduced extremity in weather, and we're now having more dry spells, and that is why the lake seems to be drying more frequently than it used to in the past. If you compare to previous drying out years, it was 2018. Before that, it was 2012, 1996, and 1973, or thereabouts. Before that, it was in the 40s. So it was a 25 to 40 year natural drying cycle. But now the recession of Lake Chilwa happens every 3 to 5 years. There are other reasons, more local conservation, as it is with many things. When people are poor, the deforestation occurs. They have to grow things, they have to cook things, and that it leads to all of that. And even the rice growing that the lake used to support so freely, depending on the water levels of Lake Chiriwa, but it hasn't been happening anymore. So there's lots of efforts trying to combat it. But while I'm proud on the one hand that my student was involved in this, on the other, it's yet another tragic example of how climate change, much of it forced on poor countries in the southern hemisphere by the abusive practices of the wealthy countries and their pollution, that has created conditions beyond the control of the African folks that are living on that piece of land. So, folks, we've got to do better.
Cette route qui va quelque part nous emmènera.
Lake Chad is not what it was. Its waters have retreated, uncovering the fertile land of its southern shores. Here, Alhaj Mazu Hassan now tills the land where he used to fish, a change of career that he says makes it easier to feed himself and his 53 children.
Fishing doesn't bring enough in. You work, you get indebted, and in the end, you're left with nothing. When there was a lot of water, I lived from fishing alone. I fished and I sold my fish to N'Djamena and to Nigeria. But since the water level has dropped, I've given up fishing and now I work the land.
Hassan's life has mirrored the changes in the lake, but the concept of climate change is that of another world.
Me, I don't know anything about all that. Only Allah knows what's happening. All I do is follow the lake.
It's what men here have always done on a lake that has grown as often as it has shrunk. This is their tale. Our guide is Abba Abu Muhammad. He was also once a fisherman. Now he buys and sells the fish caught by others. Business is good. He employs no fewer than 30 fishermen, giving them bait and food in exchange for their catch.
Things are going well, but I've got costs. The supplies I buy for my fishermen cost me a lot, and I just about make ends meet.
After some haggling, we're allowed onto his boat. First stop, the island of Kinasaram, a sort of crossroads for the four countries that share the lake, Chad, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger. A quick stop that allows us to meet one of the first fishermen to have moved to this now crowded island. At 88, Blama El Hadj Adam continues to fish every day. But even with the help of his grandsons, it's more of a struggle than it was.
There's less water, and because there are many people who come here to fish, there are now fewer fish, and the fish can hide more easily among the grasses, in the holes. I don't know where they hide. Before I was able to fill my boat, before my boat there was filled with fish.
Now the nets often come up empty, And the next generation is already looking elsewhere.
Me, I want to do a different job. Fishing is no good.
Why?
There is no money in fishing.
Part of the problem is that things were so good here for so many and for so long. Last year, though, the authorities banned the old tight meshed fishing nets. Many were simply confiscated.
People don't have good nets anymore. All their good nets have been taken. All they have left are synthetic ones. So many fishermen have fled because of that. They've gone to Cameroon, to Nigeria.
At the end of a long morning, the fishermen returned to Kinasaram. From here, the fish was once sold mainly to Nigeria, but that's now banned. This fish, hard enough to catch, will now be even harder to sell. It is prepared and cleaned by the fisherman's daughter-in-law. She will then have to sell it within Chad. Where do you sell your fish?
To N'Djamena.
You don't sell to Nigeria?
No, only to Chad.
We leave Kinasaram as we'd arrived on the fish trader's boat. At first, the navigation is tough. Tall grasses have sprouted up all around the lake as its waters have receded. But beyond the grasses lies the open water. And it is here, much further than before, near the unmarked watery border with Nigeria, that Abba Abu Muhammad must now come to drop off his fishermen. Here, far from any shore, they will spend weeks at a time.
Before we went quite far, but not as far as this. Before, to tell you the truth, there was even fish really close, over there. But now we have to follow it further out, and we have to lure it with this brand. Before, we could catch fish just like that, but now we have no choice but to use brand.
Next stop, Fitini, one of the many islands to have emerged as the lake's waters withdrew. Like Kinasaram, it long proved a magnet for fishermen from all over the region. But these children now inhabit an island that many have fled. Its chief shows us around a virtual ghost town.
Look at that. Like that, just there. The people have left. There are 200 or 300 places like this that have just been abandoned. If you want, we can look around. All of these are places that have been abandoned.
The problem, he says, is not just a lack of fish, but the new fishing rules as well. Surrounded by the island's remaining children, he tells of a veritable racket on the part of the many men in uniform.
The military, they come and they take 2 million CFA francs from you. Sometimes if they catch you trying to sell fish to Nigeria, they can even ask you for 4 million. And for a poor man, how can he pay that kind of money? 4 million? That's the value of a life.
The new rules make little sense to the fishermen of Fitini. Here it is not just livelihoods that are at stake, but lives.
If we die of hunger here, the fish will get bigger. But what for? The truth? Only Allah knows it. Not men. Even the government doesn't know the truth.
Back on our trader's boat, it isn't long before we too encounter a patrol. We're on the open water once again when our trader's attention is caught by a gunshot in the distance. Our boat is called over to a reedy bank. There, a motley group of men in camouflage, understandably camera shy, demand a patrol tax. Today, it will be the relatively light levy of a packet of cigarettes and some firewood. Our presence, it seems, has helped. Often, the price of peace can be far greater. And for the patrols, the pickings are rich. The lake is crisscrossed by boats transporting goods and much contraband. Our camera is rarely welcomed. Many of the boats are heading for Bol on the northeastern shore of the lake. It is also heavily policed and taxed, as goods arrive here from all over the region. Anything that can be traded is petrol from Nigeria and wood, lots of it, chopped from the shores of the lake.
The leeks would. They destroyed it all. What's left now?
Attempts have been made to regulate this trade, but here, as everywhere, the finger of blame is pointed at foreigners.
For the most part, it's people from Cameroon, from Nigeria, from Niger. For the most part, I said. There aren't many Chadians who cut wood here. It's mainly our neighbors, our brothers. It's them who do it.
But it is here that the consequences can be seen. Blama Mohammed has lived in the village of Bol all his life.
You see, we're arriving. There it is. This is where the water level used to be. From there to there, it used to be water. This is where we used to come and wash ourselves. Now houses have been built everywhere. Water's retreating, and we're going forward.
As for why the lake's waters have vanished, he has his own theory.
What has changed is that in Nigeria they're taking water, in Cameroon they're taking water. It's also the same in Niger and Chad. That's what's dried up the lake.
Here in Chad, on the outskirts of Bol, it is through a system of dikes that the lake's water is pumped to irrigate 12,000 hectares of farmland. Land that is now drying up. Built in better times, the systems are now suffering from vanishing waters as well as poor maintenance. Canals like this one have simply dried up, and the state-owned company that built them doesn't have the means to do very much about it.
Our lands have pumps that no longer work, pumps that are too old and that need to be repaired. There's also work that needs to be done on the hydraulics. It takes a lot of maintenance, and we need to ensure these systems work for a long time.
As a result, life in the nearest village, Matafo, is getting harder. Many have already been forced to move on.
Some people have left to fish, others to keep cattle, others to farm. So some have gone to fish, and that's how everyone has left.
Men leaving the land for the water, others leaving the water for the land. Life following the water's ebbs and flows, nowhere more so than at the grassy outposts where our fish traders' men live and work. He smiles as the day's catch is handed over. But for the men and boys who work for him, it is a hard life that has become even harder.
Fish is rare. It's really rare.
A fact that makes relations between employer and employee less easy than they were.
I don't owe you anything. You've already extorted enough money from me.
For our fish trader, though, things are going well. And he isn't too worried about the future either. He's heard something about a project involving the channeling of the Ubangi River some 1,300 kilometers away. Although climate change means nothing to him either.
That I don't know about. What I do know is that there is water in the Ubangi River and that we have to dig to bring it to Chad. The water that there is in Bangi, if they dig, the water in Lake Chad will rise.
The case is tantalizingly simple, but Lake Chad has shrunk before, and it has grown before as well. And no one has yet shown whether climate change has played any part at all.
Cette route qui va quelque part nous emmènera.
Well, that's it for Amanda this week. Thank you very much for tuning in. That last documentary, Climate Change is Lake Chad Disappearing, was produced by Centro Studi Africani, and it can be found on YouTube. It's an excellent video if you can manage to go see it as well, because it's very dramatic, the changes that are occurring, the people that, and the way that people's lives are being affected. Thanks to Owen Schock for his contribution on Canadian Aid this week. And ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
CKUT. CKUT.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
Look what you've done.